Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 312. And this week I'm joined by Graham Fellows, a.k.a. John Shuttleworth, and many other a.k.a.s. I list them at the beginning of the chat. Before we get into it, though, I want to say thank you so much for all the love for last week's episode. It was a pretty special one. I was joined by Michael Cashman, and a lot of people were already aware of him and excited about it, and a lot of people weren't familiar with him but were blown away by the episode. It's honestly one of the biggest reactions I've got on the social media channels about any of the chats. So, yeah, thank you for that. But this week's guest is incredibly exciting. He's in the middle of a tour at the moment. I'll run through his full kind of the remainder of his tour dates at the end, but I'll just tell you now that if you listen to this on the Wednesday, this week he's in Salford, Newcastle, Scunthorpe, and then next week Wakefield, Margate, Brighton, London, Leicester Square Theatre, Monday the 2nd of March till the 3rd of March, and a load of other places. And I also want to tell you that, again, if you're listening on the Wednesday, his new book, Two Margarines and Other Domestic Dilemmas, John Shuttleworth's Guide to Everyday Life, comes out tomorrow on February 20th. We talk about all of these things in the podcast and in the conversation. We talk about where we first met, the cupboard that we shared for a month, or a number of weeks at least, and other things like that. So let's just jump into the chat, right? Obviously, always brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's where you can buy stuff from me. This week actually should be the week that the limited edition clear glow-in-the-dark vinyl of the Distraction Pieces album comes out in the Speech Development Records web store. If it's not there already, if you go and have a look, speechdevelopmentrecords.com. If it's not there already, it'll be there by the end of the week, hopefully. And obviously patreon.com/ScroobiusPip is where you can get previews, little behind-the-scenes things. But in reality, it's just a way to support the podcast if you want to in a small way. It's $1 a month. You can pay more, but there's no extra tiers or anything. It's just $1 a month or whatever you want to give a month because you feel it's worth it. But no pressure on that. I'd much rather you spend that money on going and catching John Shuttleworth's return to the stage on this current tour, or his return to literature in his book, Two Margarines and Other Domestic Dilemmas. Oh, and also, before I go into it, I'm going to give you a bonus podcast on Friday. I'm going to give you a chat with Rich Wilson, a comedian and podcaster. I'm a big fan of his Insane in the Membrane podcast, and I saw his Fringe show, and I thought he was wonderful, and he's got a Soho Theatre run coming up. So we're going to have a chat, and I'll give you that on Friday. So let's hear from Graham Fellows / John Shuttleworth / many other things on episode 312 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Yeah, so I've started rolling as we're still kind of setting things up. I'm joined today by Graham Fellows, a.k.a. John Shuttleworth, a.k.a. Brian Appleton, a.k.a. Dave Tordoff. Is that correct?
Going further back, a.k.a.
Jilted John.
Yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of a.k.a.s in there. I'm delighted to have you on for a chat. I've followed a lot of your different stuff over the years, but let's start with that we kind of met in a cupboard, essentially, because the backstage area of the Pleasance Ace Dome at the Pleasance at the Fringe is kind of a cupboard.
Yeah, it was very much a cupboard.
And we were sharing that because your show was on before mine, and then you were getting in and out of costume as I was kind of pacing about nervously.
And I was pacing nervously. Who was on first?
So you were on first.
Right, so I was coming off a bit sweaty and no longer nervous, just a bit frustrated that I wasn't any better.
So at that Fringe run, you were doing Brian Appleton, and it was the first time I'd seen him. How do you kind of
we were discussing this before we got started, but what's your relationship with the Fringe? It's an unusual beast, isn't it?
Well, it is. Yeah, I mean, I used to have a very strong relationship with the Fringe. '92 was my first Fringe, and it was my best. I nearly won the Perrier Award.
Wow.
I was nominated anyway, but there was some very stiff competition, including Steve Coogan and Joe Brown and Mark Thomas.
Yeah, that's a group to be in, right?
Yeah, but that was my most memorable Fringe, and I did it for quite a few years, actually. But as we were discussing before we press record, it's very much a young person's thing, and you can get sort of swept away by the sheer size of it. And I personally felt a sense of diminishing returns with it. And not emotionally, I found it quite taxing and a bit soul-destroying. Even when you had a good run with people coming, it's just you feel insignificant, and performers don't like to feel insignificant. So I don't do it very often now. But I did a show two years ago as myself on the Free Fringe for the first time. First time doing a show out of character.
Yeah.
And it was called Completely Out of Character. You know, and it was a free show. And I did it to test myself, and I'm really glad I did. But I'm not sure I'd do it again.
Yeah,
I quite like the comfort of people paying a lot of money to see me.
Yeah, it's nice. But again, they're invested in the night and the performance, then it's not just some random people who've strolled in off the street. So
yeah,
there is a difference in the even just in the tone from the start. You know, you may have a full room, but you don't know if they have any idea who you are. They're already, and particularly, I guess, more so. Oh no, in any situation when you've had a career of multiple characters and multiple different things, the more they know about you, the better, in a way.
Yes, I think most of the people who came to see me did have an inkling of what they were going to get, or at least they knew my past work.
Yeah,
and so we're invested to some extent. But I think it's great to play to an audience that isn't necessarily won over by the fact that they've paid 20 quid to see you already.
Yeah,
and I think when people do that, they actually are on your side because they've spent the money. They're determined to have a good time, so you can get away with more.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't be like that. The more they pay, the better you should be, and the harder it should be. But
yeah, but completely agree.
But we like most people who do a free show. I had a little technique whereby if they paid £10 on the way out, they got a free CD. You got to do little things like that.
Yeah,
and that worked pretty well.
How have you found over the years presenting a new character at something like The Fringe? But then I guess it applies to touring in general, because John Shuttleworth is an iconic character, and I said that's who you had the success with in '92. Is that correct?
Yeah.
At The Fringe. So because there is so much variation and so many options up there, people are half glancing at a poster or a sign or listings. They're not necessarily going in the details bit, they're saying this is a character from Graham Fellows, previous this. They might just be scrolling through and going, I don't know who that is, on to the next one. How do you find that as a thing to overcome, I guess?
I think with Edinburgh, that's what makes it difficult. But that's why I say it's a young person's game, because if you're inexperienced and excited and don't mind sleeping on a floor, then it's, you, in a way, you don't have any expectations. You're going to have a good time, and you're going to learn a lot from doing a show for 3 weeks to sometimes difficult crowds. But I suppose I've been doing stand-up now for 92. Well, I was doing John Shuttleworth in gigs in 86, you know, 87.
Wow.
So it's over 30 years now. But I suppose you build up your following and you get a little bit spoiled because people come and they know you, so you've got your crowd. So I think The Fringe, for me anyway, it's a bit of a test to toughen you up as a performer, because you get spoiled just playing to your own crowd. I'm about to do that again. I'm about to go on tour, big 50-plus date tour, and people are paying, and most of them know what they're coming to get. But it's great when people come up afterwards and say, I hadn't seen you before, and I didn't know what to expect. I loved it, you know, which is does seem to happen still.
Yeah. I think it's great as well, particularly when you've had a career that spans that amount of time. There will still be people who like particularly with a character like John Shuttleworth, who you've taken some time off from, there will be people who have been introduced to him in that time, who have found out about him in that time, that will be new to the live a performance of it all. So that must be an exciting thing to go. It's not just, obviously it's great to have your regular and loyal audience, but as you said, it's so much more exciting at points to have the people that they've brought along, or that they've said, you've got to come to this show. Or I was talking to Kevin Smith on the podcast recently. He was saying he's had a lot where it's people who are bringing their children along who have got into it, and they've bonded over a shared taste in comedy and things like that. That's a massive thing, right?
I get quite a bit of that. Yeah. And I like that. And it does happen more with me, perhaps, than some comedians, because my act is squeaky clean. There's not a swear word in sight.
Yeah.
And I used to do a song called Up and Down Like a Bride's Nighty.
Right.
When I was a younger man, and I thought that was... I don't think John would sing that, you see, now.
Yeah.
Or if he do it occasionally in the encore, but the way I justify it is that John doesn't really understand what he's saying.
Yeah, I love that. Well, for people who don't know, obviously John Shuttleworth is an iconic character. Explain him to anyone who may not know who John is.
Well, the best way to do that is to tell you how he came into being, which was in 85. I'd just signed a publishing deal for my songs, because I was a serious songwriter, and that's what I wanted to be. I went to drama school. I did acting for quite a few years, and the acting work was drying up. Meanwhile, I'd had this big hit, Jilted John, better known as Gordon is a Moron, in 1978, and that had sort of switched me on to songwriting, and I was always writing songs, even like in the wings waiting to go on to do a play. I'd be sort of honing a lyric, which is a bit disastrous when you're about to go on and do a big Shakespeare speech.
I've got this other idea.
Yeah.
This is all well and good, William, but I've got a few things I'm toying with at
that's
the moment.
That's it. But so I was... It's a lovely, happy accident, actually, that I created this character that married music and acting. And what happened was I signed this deal, and the A&R guys, and they were all men. I don't know if they are now, but they all seem to be men. And they got a bit bored listening to normal stuff. So they used to get these, what they call turkey tapes, you know, which were like really bad demos that wannabe performers of the ilk of John Shuttleworth were sending in. And I remember one, this guy was playing the keyboard and you could hear someone washing up in the background.
Yeah. I love it.
And then there was another one, a guy called Ross Cochran, who we speculated he might be an amateur DJ, but he put a lot of reverb on. And at the end of his song reel, he would say, "Thank you very much for listening to my songs. If there's anything of interest, please get in contact. If you wish to change any of the lyrics or the tunes, that's fine. That can be done." You know, and it was so sad that he'd said that. It was like he was so accommodating.
Here's my offering, but also change anything you want.
Yeah.
Here's my art, but hope you like it. If you don't, we can do something different.
I guess he thought he was being very businesslike about it because, you know, that does happen. A publisher will say, you know, well, ditch the second verse and go straight to the chorus kind of thing. So I was inspired to create my own turkey tape, and that's how John Shuttleworth started. I made my own tape at home. I sent it into this publisher friend, and one I particularly wanted to tease, and they loved it, and they gradually clocked it was me, because I think I did another follow-up tape. Now, what happened there is suddenly all my serious songs that I'd been working on, my Graham Fellows love ballads, and it was a bit sort of indie pop, mid-'80s, this was. And I had an album called Love at the Hacienda, which that song was about, the nightclub in Manchester.
Yes.
And it was well received, and it still is now. It's a big iconic, to use the word you've been using a few times about me. It's an iconic record in Japan, and
amazing.
The vinyl can exchange for £200. But my Graham Fellows stuff was totally back burner instantly. We want John Shuttleworth tapes. Now, I was delighted to do that, but a few years later, I suddenly thought, shit, I'm not making it as a songwriter.
I've killed my own career. But the real me, John, has killed my... I've invented the person who's killed my own...
But the nice, there's a nice little irony there, because, of course, John Shuttleworth is a failed songwriter.
Yeah.
He can't... He's not successful. In his world, the Sheffield ex-security guard, ex-Comet audio salesman...
Yeah.
He wanted to be on Toasters at one point, but anyway, he... he's a failure,
yeah.
And it was like I was a failure. But, of course, John Shuttleworth did take off, and it was a very slow build-up. For the first 2 or 3 years, I was just making my tapes, you know?
Yeah.
And I did the odd gig. There were two phases of Shuttleworth, really. The first one, I had lots of toys on top of the keyboard. And I had a tape of the backing tracks, which right. I played on a tape recorder underneath my keyboard, hidden. It was a shell of an old Farfisa. Amazing. Organ, and I just pressed play on the cassette, which was wired up to the PA, mimed along on this dummy keyboard, and these clockwork... Do you remember those dogs that you get in the market that go...
They do the flip. Yeah.
They do the flip. I used to have that, and I used to have a robot and a little baby in a walk-in frame. And the idea behind that was it was to stop people... It was to be funny, I guess, and it was to amuse a drunken heavy rock audience, because that was the audiences that I... was playing. And I even supported Robert Plant.
Amazing.
From Led Zepp at one point on his comeback gig. But that all ended because it wasn't really going anywhere and it needed more substance. It was a 20-minute act. It was vaudeville.
Yeah.
And I had a few personal setbacks, like my mum died and my dog died, you know, and I just, it all collapsed and it took a long, I went back to acting and did a couple of years in rep, and we're now early 90s, and that's when I suddenly started thinking of him as a comedy act on the stand-up scene.
Yeah.
And then, well, meanwhile, I'd built up John's back, his world of his wife, Mary, his next-door neighbour, Ken Worthington, who was on New Faces in 1973.
Yeah.
He came last, but it was definitely him, Scroobius, you know. Because I saw that particular edition. You might have been too young, or maybe you're out on your space hopper, enjoying what remained of that sunny evening. So it became sort of more poetical, and it wasn't, oh, that robot's just fallen off. Pick it up, lad. It became a much more Alan Bennett-y sort of Mike Lee world of monologue. It was a monologue. Yeah. And then the songs were in between the chart.
That must have been a really... interesting and exciting development from your side of it, because at first it's there particularly at that era there was, what is the place for comedy songs? Where do they sit? They might do well in the charts, but they're not going to be in the Enemy or respected or whatever else. Again, at that point we'd gone past the vaudeville or cabaret shows that had a mixture of music and comedy and stuff like that. Stand up was had its alternative stand up kind of boom, where it was all very much people with a microphone and things like that. So that must have been great to find. It's not just the songs; it's the gaps in between the songs. It's the stories that link the songs. It's the stories that got John to the gig that day and things like that become as important, if not more important, than the songs themselves. So coming from acting, that must have been a nice thing to go, right, it's a piece rather than a gig, if you know what I mean, or a set.
Yeah. I think I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it just changed. It in a way, it broadened what I could do. I stopped supporting heavy rock bands and started doing places like the Chuckle Club and the Meccano Club, the Red Rose. This is because I was living in London. I'd had a stint at being a milkman, and do you know, I didn't get a single glimpse of Negligee.
It's poorly misrepresented in advertising. It's not the life it's claimed to be.
No. But I started making a living, doing a small living, making, as John Shuttleworth, doing the circuit. But I soon realised I couldn't play everywhere. You know, there's the club jongleurs.
Yeah.
With the chicken and the basket sort of audience who need knob gags, and they weren't really going to warm to Shuttleworth because I made him a very real person. So I didn't send it up too much. It was, you know, I wanted it to be a faithful rendition of a man who was a bit rubbish, but was eternally optimistic and a nice man, you know. But he just wanted to play his songs on the organ and explain that, I sent a tape to Paul Young of this song, but I forgot to put Dolby on, so it was a bit hissy, you know. So I presume that's why he sent it me back, you know. And
yeah.
Audiences had to just have a little bit of a leap of intelligence or faith. They had to, it wasn't in-your-face comedy. It drew you in.
Yeah, it wasn't
if you wanted
him
to be drawn
a slapsticky character. It was that's keeping it. Him at a reality level and finding that humour within it.
And if people didn't want to be drawn in, then they just started chattering.
Yeah.
And that was what I feared in my early gigs when I wasn't really known. Occasionally, you know, you get off your crap, you can't sing, John can't. Well, he's got better. He's got a nice. Sometimes I think as John, I sound a bit Tom Waitsy, actually. Because there's especially when I sing, I can't go back to Savory Now. Do you know that one?
I don't know that.
Well, that's John's sort of biggest hit, really, yeah. Apart from Pigeons in Flight. Can't go back to Savory Now. There's a Tom Waits little there, isn't there?
There really is.
But I just, I guess I had to learn my craft. I mean, I'd been an actor, so I was applying those rules. And I couldn't really play the keyboard. Some would argue I still can't particularly, but that's okay because John isn't that good. So I play to the best of my ability on the keyboard. And I use the same keyboard I've been using since 93. It's a kid's organ, basically. It's a Yamaha PSS-51.
I love it.
And it's got the mini keys. And that's nice because it means I've got quite big hands and quite often, I play the wrong note, you know?
Yeah.
I play a bum note. And audiences love it and they think, oh, he's so clever. He's so clever. He's done that Les Dawson thing and played the bum. But it's not deliberate. It's just what happens.
I love that. I mean, that's kind of the benefit of writing a character like this. I mean, I guess particularly in those early days of opening for like rock bands and stuff like that, how was it writing a character that essentially, if you nail it, it hasn't gone that well? If you know what I mean, because I've seen it with Brian Gittins, who I brought on tour with me once, and Neil Hamburger and people like that. The point is they're not very good. Mm-hmm. But before you're in a stand-up situation where people are aware that it's not meant to be good and can appreciate it on that extra level, you're going out and kind of the aim is to make people a little bit, or a lot of the crowd going, this guy's ridiculous, like laughing at him and not realising that they're laughing with you.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. So, how was that as a thing?
Well, it was a learning curve, and it got easier the more developed the act got. But I do remember Pops in the early 90s doing a gig in Glasgow, and they always say Glasgow's the toughest crowd, don't they? Yeah. But there were four people sort of noisily walked out from the gallery, and I heard later that they demanded their money back because I couldn't, they weren't going to watch someone who couldn't sing, and it was just so awful.
Yeah,
but that, in a way, was confirmation that the character was still believable, you know. Yeah. But I guess it is, to some extent, a piece of theatre, and an audience has to. It works best when they know the joke, that they know the guy isn't very good, but he is good as well, because the songs are good songs, and I think that's why it's lasted this long, because I Can't Go Back to Savory Now is a real truism, you know. You have your main course, and then you have your pudding, you can't go back to your main course. Another big favourite of that people love is Two Margarines on the Go.
Yeah.
It's the nightmare scenario. And, the idea of having two margarines open in your fridge, to John, that is the worst thing possible.
I love it because it's taking genuine pop sensibilities and applying them to observational comedy, essentially, if that makes sense. It is stuff that everyone can relate to, but stuff that no one would write a song about other than John, which makes it that kind of, if it was only one or the other, it wouldn't work, if you know what I mean. If it was just a song that's about something relatable, but it's shit, it wouldn't work. It needs to have those hooks and everything else that works, and vice versa. It was a great song, but it was just a bad pop song, I guess. It wouldn't sit there either, so it's the balance of the two.
I think you're right. I mean, when I started writing for John, it was a little bit self-conscious. I was thinking, this has got to be a crap song. So, like Pigeons in Flight was deliberate. The lyric was slightly off-kilter. So he goes, Pigeons in Flight. I mean, the Pigeons in Flight, it should be doves, of course, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Pigeons in Flight, I want to see you tonight. I want to hold you, if I may be so bold to, and tell you some things that you'd like to hear, oh, my dear, in your ear. You know, it's really clunky.
It's clunky.
But a few years later, I was wanting John's songs to be better. And what happened was I'd write a song for myself in my downtime from Shuttleworth. I'd write, because I still had ambitions, you know, with my own songs. And then I'd think, well, I wrote a song called The Man Who Lives on the M62. You know, the guy on the farm. Do you know that motorway?
Right, yeah.
Between Manchester. And it's a farm.
Right.
And it's a metaphor for how you make a mistake, but it's too late. You've let the motorway be built around your farm. And I thought, well, I'll give it to John. So I gave John this beautiful... it's like leaving on a jet plane. I nicked the tune slightly. Feel like the man who lives on that farm which sits in the middle of the M62. Thought it would be all right. Now I can't sleep at night. Some things you cannot undo. And, you know, it's a nice tune with a good, not a bad lyric.
Yeah.
But that's how John's songs have become. They're good songs, you know.
Yeah.
But they're about something that, like you say, normal, self-respecting rock stars wouldn't sing about.
Or that's an interesting kind of area to look at then, because you did, as said, you had chart success with Jilted John, played by John Peel, and, you know, it was respected as what it was and things like that. What was the decision to go in the direction that you were going in? Was there a right, I need to stick with stuff that I'm trying to get in the charts, or I need to go to stuff that I'm trying to get in the clubs and in the venues and in the, you know, up and down the country on tours?
Yeah, I mean, I Can't Go Back to Savory Now was a single, and we reached number 96 in the top 100.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's the second time I was in the charts.
Yeah.
John got to number 4.
Yeah.
And sold 500,000. And so I think it was a very hard act to follow, Jilted John. And just going back to that, it was the right time. You know, if I brought that out now, it would just disappear, because I suspect, and I don't understand the charts now, I don't understand. I was talking about this the other night with a songwriter friend. It's got to be used for an advert or a film, hasn't it? And then it becomes successful. But then it was still a very good time for novelty songs to come out. Mm-hmm. The Barren Knights were still regularly getting songs in the charts, where they would just do a comic parody of a song that was already in the charts. You know, the pop single was just so respected as an art form. And it was a lovely thing. You know, DJs would say, oh, I've got the new single here from Racy. And I don't know why I chose Racy. Can't stand Racy, but John loves them, obviously.
Yeah.
And you'd play it, and then you'd listen to it, and then you'd hear it a few hours later, and there were playlists, and it was a very exciting time. So it was a good time for John to be picked up, and it was a certain amount of luck, certain amount of naivety that, on my part, even thinking it, I just didn't see any obstacles. I made the demo with my friend Bernard in his bedsit in Manchester, with him tapping out the melody, the rhythm on a Monopoly box.
Amazing.
And all the pieces, you know, inside were providing a lovely rattle, like, you know, the snare on a snare drum. And we didn't use that in the... But anyway, I took that to I made another demo for £25 and then took that to the only punk label I'd heard of in Manchester, Rabid Records, because I don't think Factory Records were up and running then.
Right.
And they just put out the Buzzcocks' Spiral Scratch. Martin Hannett had produced it. He was the legendary producer, sadly no longer with us. And so he was the one that was chosen to he was the only, he was their in-house producer, and he produced Jilted John. And it all just sort of came together really naturally. And it was good fun. Good days.
It's key there, the not knowing the limits or boundaries. I think that's one of the key things for so many things artistically, is not having the knowledge to question it, rather than going, well, I could never do this or never do that. You go,
well, you were like that when I met you in that cupboard.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you were still quite fresh and new, weren't you?
Yeah.
And look at you now with your big podcast.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's a massive thing. I think there's so much now, and it's something I want to talk about as well, because particularly in working class areas, there's so much that's that we're told is out of our reach, or have traditionally been told is out of our reach. So you were you in Sheffield? Did you?
I grew up in Sheffield. Yeah.
Yeah. So was that kind of era of the punk scene blowing up and people doing it for themselves, was that an inspiration to get into whether it's acting or music or comedy or all these things? Because again, there's a lot of those areas that you might have had your working man's club comics, but that's not no young man looks at the working man's club comics, which were normally in their 50s or 40s or whatever else, and goes, oh, I could be that, because it's an older guy. So there's so much in those areas that you're not told at that age, oh, you can be in entertainment, or you can be in this, or you can be in that. So, what inspired you and what drew you to go, I want to do acting, I want to do music, I want to do all of these things?
Well, yeah, I just didn't see any obstacles. I mean, I was in school plays from a young age, and it's funny, just mentioning the Working Men's Club. I used to work behind the bar in the Working Men's Club, and I'm sure some of the characters I met there informed John Shuttleworth. You know, that sort of very steady. There was an early review of John Shuttleworth, which actually was in the Melody Maker, and I loved it because it said the schoolmaster. John Shuttleworth is the schoolmaster who could never be phased.
Yeah.
You know, because he's just deadpan. It's just, what do you mean, lad? You know. In fact, I used to get heckles early on, like, get off your rubbish, or ruder words than that. I said, excuse me, don't interrupt. Do you talk to your parents like that? And, of course, that wasn't a very good put-down.
Yeah.
They just go, fuck up.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it was all happened very accidentally, organically. As I say, it was naivety. It was just that thing of, well, you know, just do it. And I think, hopefully, young people still feel the same thing. Yeah. And, you know, with YouTubing and blogging and... it's just a shame that Top of the Pops was taken off. I've got a theory about what happened there.
Right.
And I blame one man, Michael Hurl.
Right.
Who was the producer. And he basically turned... Or the people around him did, just because I get sued. The team that ran Top of the Pops changed the whole ethos of it. So you go back to the 60s and think about, like, the Rolling Stones playing songs, and you had the audience looking up and adoring them, and they were involved, but they weren't sort of clapping along. And they introduced, like, a whoop track, didn't they, in the 80s. It happened with sort of disco and everything. Suddenly, you didn't have the record on its own. You had people clapping and then an audience going, woo!
Yeah.
Woo! And what happened there is the song gets diminished, and it becomes less serious and less meaningful. The song just becomes a backdrop to a party.
Yeah.
I think Top of the Pops started to become, it's a party. And that, therefore, the songs lost their meaning. And, you know, we used to, every single that came out, it's got a massive backstory, you know. It would have taken months to write and produce, and they got the bass player, he got ill, and then there's a whole story behind every record. And singles lost their importance, and Top of the Pops contributed to that. And that's why I think the BBC were able to say, well, it's not a very important programme anymore, let's axe it. And that helped to kill the single and the charts, and it's a tragedy.
It's really interesting, because we've...
Can I just say, though, to my age group, it's a tragedy.
Yeah.
Maybe younger people are saying, well, no, it's not, because it allowed YouTubing, blogging, all that to come through. And if the charts were still... and Top of the Pops was still reigning supreme, that wouldn't have happened, I don't know.
Yeah, arguably, but I think it's a really interesting point, though. I was listening to someone talking recently about producing and televising live sports events. So whether that be American football, it was an America thing, whether it be American football, boxing, wrestling, all of these different things, is... on TV, you want to make it look like the biggest party and you want to be there. But that's because they're trying to sell tickets for every other game and live events. Mm. Top of the Pops aren't trying to sell tickets for Top of the Pops. They should be trying to sell singles.
Yes.
So trying to make it this destination, look how great it is here, all you're doing is alienating the people in the living room who can't be there, who can't go, who aren't at a party. Mm. And it diminishes it. Whereas I think you're right, prior to that, if you're at home, you're getting to hear this song, you're getting to hear this single, and that's what it's about. You're connecting to the song, to the single, to the artist, to the band, rather than watching a party that you weren't invited to and kind of feeling alienated. So, yeah.
I don't really like parties.
It's definitely an interesting one.
I always get anxious if I'm invited to a party.
Oh, I'm the same. I'm not a fan at all.
I can enjoy them once I'm there.
Yeah.
I do spend a lot of time in the kitchen.
I can enjoy them once I've left. Like once I've looked,
how can you do that?
Well, while I'm there, I'm even if I'm having the best time, I'm constantly thinking, have I been here long enough to head home yet? Or what time should I leave? Or is it okay? Is anyone going to be offended? And once I'm gone, I can go, oh, I really enjoyed that part. And I really enjoy, but in the moment, I'm rarely having this amazing time because I'm constantly thinking of when I can leave. I'm just
do,
not a
do
party
you have guy. A when's the last time you had your own party?
I honestly can't remember the last time I had my own party.
Have you ever had one?
I moved into my current house maybe 5 or 6 years ago and I didn't have a housewarming party of any sorts. The closest I've had is occasionally having family over for a birthday. But I'm not a party guy. How about you? Are you a host?
No, I'm not, but it's funny because I'm renting a flat in Leicester with my girlfriend. I've discovered the city again after years of being in a small market town in Lincolnshire, which interestingly has informed a lot of the world of John Shuttleworth because although he's from Sheffield, the kind of the world that he talks about and which people seem to love is kind of a bit cuter and a bit more bucolic and old fashioned, and it's Louth in Lincolnshire. But anyway, I've discovered the city again, lovely, bustling, multicultural city of Leicester. And we're going to have a flat warming, but I'm suddenly getting very anxious about it because it's all right going to, it's bad enough going to other parties where, you might not enjoy it, but to throw your own party, you know, it's hard work, but we're going to do it. But we're arguing about the vol-au-vents. I only knew that there were mushroom vol-au-vents, but my girlfriend says, well, apparently, what you're talking about? There's egg and there's... I can't remember the other. There's loads of different types. Do you know many types of vol-au-vent?
I'm not hugely well versed in vol-au-vents. At school, I had an art teacher, and he felt that art was the most important subject of all. And art was always after French for me. And he would always get angry if we were late for art because French had overrun. And he would say angrily, "The only French you ever need, and the only French you will remember, is voulez-vous ou vol-au-vent." Yeah. That's all you need to know. And that's the only French that stuck with me. He was completely right. But also, that's my only real interaction with vol-au-vents.
So you've never actually had one?
I don't think I have, you know. As a youth, I was a very picky eater. I generally ate meat, cheese, and the wide variety of potatoes. Other than that, there wasn't a lot going on. So, yeah.
The wide variety of potatoes?
Yes. I mean, potatoes should be... I feel it should be its own food group because of... Chips, mash.
I thought you meant different, like Jersey Royal or...
No. I mean, we can go even further there, but still, sweet potatoes still count in there, and there's... Yeah, I think
lovely.
There's so much.
That I had some last night. They're lovely, aren't they? Different. It's a different vegetable.
And I'd feel that a roast potato feels incredibly different to, for example, mash or a potato waffle, for example. I think there's such a great versatility...
An instant mash
within
as
the
well.
Potato. Yep.
Do you like instant mash? Because sometimes that can be a lovely change, I find.
I became a fan of, when I first got my own flat, I became a big fan of frozen mash. That it's like little, it looks like little pellets that you put a load of them in the microwave. They're microwave and you've got this wonderful
I've never
fresh
discovered
mash.
That.
Yeah.
Ah, to try that. But, you know, let's not abandon the topic of vol-au-vents so quickly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I seriously think that they are endangered.
Yeah, I agree.
Because as a kid, I used to see vol-au-vents all the time. And I suspect, I've never made them, but they're probably quite hard to make. There's a lot of effort in there. And I went to a funeral recently. I thought, well, that's the last bastion of the vol-au-vent. You're going to find lots of vol-au-vents on the table, along with the quiche. And there were no vol-au-vents.
Yeah.
And I just... So we're definitely going to have vol-au-vents at our party.
Vol-au-vents are the Edinburgh fringe of the snack world. It's just a diminishing return. There's so much competition.
Yeah.
Then what's the point in, you know, if there's an option of cocktail sausages or all of these other spread options, it's tough, I think.
It is. But then vol-au-vents are disappearing. I think what are making a massive comeback. It's a sort of gradual comeback. To my perception, is the custard cream biscuit.
Yeah.
Because when I go around to people's houses, I'm seeing them on a plate. They're being offered to me. And they're not going to go away. And I've got a theory. Well, we're going back to John Shuttleworth now. I'm not particularly doing... I don't tend to do John unless I'm dressed up as him. But I could slip into him for the audio. Well, you know, I think John's obsessed about why the custard cream is doing so well. It's the diamond, isn't it, Pip?
It makes sense.
Called you Scrooby, sir. I'm going to call you Pip because it's less trouble.
It is.
But the diamond shape, people can mine a diamond, can't they, when they have a custard cream? Because you have to eat the edges and leave the diamond in the middle.
Yeah, but, makes sense.
But it's worthless. You know, you can't put it in a ring or anything like that. You still have to eat it. But I just think it adds to its value.
It's true.
Yeah. That's work in progress. Because I'm working on my new show. And I've just got a little, in my notes it says, talk about custard creams. And I just thought I'd try it out on you. But
it's perfect.
It needs honing.
I like it. No, it's true, because it's mining something that ultimately in the end is a disappointment, because it's a custard diamond. It's the diamond is in fact the bit that's missing, if you know what I mean, because you're mining something that's not there.
Well, it is there. The diamond is very... you see, if it was a square, the biscuit would have failed many years ago. Nobody would be interested.
It's true. It's true.
It's subconscious, you know.
Yeah.
But that diamond is what draws people to the custard cream.
I like it. And I think,
yeah.
I see a resurgence. I also see a resurgence in custard tarts of recent time. I thought they were gone. And then I'm seeing... more and more, particularly in like cool little artisan bakeries and stuff like that.
Not
the custard tart I grew up with, but still, I didn't know what they were for ages. Like, oh, what are these things? Then I've realised, oh, that's just a fancy custard tart. I thought they were.
But instead of costing 80p, they cost £5.95.
Yeah. But they taste fairly similar, which is a
Where do you stay? Are you a Londoner?
No, I'm not. I'm out in Essex. Okay. I've lived in the same small town my whole life, in Stamford Lee Hope. So I've got that similar small town feel of everything, and familiarity and weird nuances.
Yeah. No, because I just suddenly, the pioneer shops, you know, because I had that once and I nearly threw up.
Yeah.
And some people love it, but pie and mash, not even the eels, just
and liquor.
That liquor.
Yeah.
I didn't understand it.
Yeah. And my family were all South London, so they were all big fans of pie mash and liquor, and I never went down the eel route, but I'd enjoy the pie mash and liquor, but it would be a far bigger event to them than it was to me. I guess it's wrapped up in nostalgia in that way.
I'm suddenly tired of talking about food and want to discuss my career a bit more.
Well,
can we do that?
Yeah, we can. We can move on to that.
We don't have to.
What's kind of drawn you to bring John back for this big tour? And it's a big tour, and I think... It's something that always strikes me with comedians is when they go on tour, or more, it's quite traditional that when stand-ups go on tour, they go on a tour. It's a good... Is it 3 months or 4 months?
Well, yes, and the reason for that is you plot your dates in and you say it's just going to be January to the middle of March, and then certain theatres you want to play can only do April the 4th.
Yeah.
So, okay. We'll stick that one in because it's going to be a good banker, that one. And then you get someone else wants, they can do the 7th of April, and then it extends beyond your original.
Around it.
Yeah. And that's okay. I mean, I guess I love touring. I have a few strands as John Shuttleworth now. You know, I don't do telly really. Mm. I do the odd little cameo appearance, but apart from my only TV series in 97, 500 Bus Stops, which is still on DVD. It's still, people like it, you know. And I did a few Jonathan Ross Saturday Zoo. I've not really been a TV character. It's been radio. You know, I've done a lot of radio series.
Yeah.
And I've made them all at home, you know, on my own little, started off on a cassette recorder. And still, even now, it's a 90s Roland VS1680. You know, you can buy them on eBay for 200 quid. But that's what I'm comfortable with. I tried Logic and all that, and I couldn't get to grips with it because it's the workflow, isn't it? You got to have a good workflow, and I do all the voices, and I have to be able to work quite quickly. And so that's, by the way, getting back to what I was, what were we talking about?
Oh, it's fascinating there. I think you've mentioned something that I think is key. There is learning something and getting good at it rather than constantly going, here's the new upgrade, here's the new update. Because then you're setting, Logic might be able to do loads more, but you're setting yourself back a year or two to get to the level you were on the one that you know that's well. It. And that's,
well,
know,
ultimately,
it can be a backwards thing.
Because ultimately it's not, especially with what I do, it's not the quality of the actual sound. It's the quality of the words of what, it's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And if I'm doing John's Wife, I need to be able to access vary speed instantly.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember moving from my Porter studio. You know, I did my first radio series for the BBC that got Sony nominated on a blinking Tascam 244, you know?
Yeah.
And the BBC never knew because they, if they'd known, they wouldn't have aired it.
Yeah.
But it's many years ago now. I'm happy to sort of trumpet the fact that they were duped because it was good enough. I knew it was. But I could access vary speed because I'd slow down the tape a bit, then record Mary's voice. So she'd say, John, hello. You all right, love? Talking a bit slower than perhaps it would come out. Well, then you press the button again. It goes to normal speed. And you go, hello, John. You all right, love?
Yeah.
And it's got picked up a bit of female characteristics, a bit of sibilance, which for some reason seems to happen when you speed things up. And when I moved to an ADAT, this digital thing that came in the late 80s, I couldn't do it. It took about a minute to increment the speed very slowly. So about a minute later, I'd get to the tape speed I needed, and I'd lost the inspiration. And then, you know, I need to be able to check things instantly. So it's all about the workflow. And I've just stuck with this machine. I've just done a Christmas special that is going out. I don't know when this is going out. You props don't know yet.
This will be going out in the new year, so it'll be after the Christmas special, I'd imagine. But
yeah, it'll still be on the... all my stuff's on BBC Sounds now.
Yeah.
I think I've done about 11 or 12 series now on radio. Fantastic. And almost all of them had been done at home.
Yeah.
I've just done... This was done in a wardrobe.
Yeah.
Hey, where we met.
Yeah, yeah.
But I recorded it in a wardrobe in my flat in Leicester.
Yeah.
With a sort of a clothes rail of coats to dampen the sound.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about radio. It's just so versatile.
Yeah.
You can do it anywhere. I once was acting. I went back to acting to do a kids' TV series, but I had to do that in the daytime. And in the evenings, I had to do a series for Radio 4 of the Shuttleworths. So I did that in my hotel bedroom. And it was on the A1. You'd think I was a bit noisy, but it was triple glazing. And I was able to open this. I had a big wardrobe, and I put a duvet on each door and sat in almost inside the wardrobe. So the sound was nice and dead.
Yeah.
And I recorded the radio show at night, and it, sounds great.
I love that. I love that. That, and again, I think you're completely right, is people will record things in this perfect situation and then spend ages trying to make it sound imperfect and trying to get unknowingly get the effect of having two duvets over wardrobe doors and sitting in a wardrobe and recording it. And yeah, if you don't tell them how you got to that result, then they don't know.
But
they're going to assume you've gone these specific routes. It's like, no,
you can do it in TV as well. I was watching an old episode of Father Ted last night, and there's some really dodgy, sort of cheap video effects in it.
Yeah.
And I just thought, but the writing is so good and the acting is so good and the inspiration is so good. It's that one where the priests all end up in a women's lingerie shop. And it just had me, I was just laughing, killing myself laughing, because it's just about the characters. And it's what you do, not how you do it, really. This relates also to music. When I was had my publishing deal, I was, for a while, I was trying to write songs for Five Star, for God's sake. Well, I was working with a guy who had written Rain or Shine and Systematic, and they had this thing, the publishers, they would pair two people together. Like, he was good on keyboards and sequences, and they thought, well, my lyrics are quite quirky, let's get them together. We wrote a couple of songs, but it didn't really happen. But the whole ethos for recording then in the 80s was get the snare sound as big and loud as you can. Get that kick drum sounding. And you'd spend hours doing that. And the vocal, that was the... You'd do a vocal over several days and you'd drop it in bit by bit. Yeah, we're just going to drop you in for the word love. And coming up, you know, because and that's not how it should be.
No,
because,
I agree.
And that's why so many of the 80s records sound so sort of anodyne. And they have a particular quality, but, I mean, you should really do a vocal in one.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't right, do it again. Didn't hurt the four tops.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, though, because I think whatever bit of technical information you hear or learn is the one that you're going to obsess over. I remember when I was working on an album, because an album I loved, I'd seen a documentary where they literally just hung an SM58 over the drums and recorded it like that. I was like, and it's my favourite sound and all this. That's not always going to work in every room and with every drum kit and things like that. But because I'd heard that's how they did it, then when I tried it on something I was working, I was like, all right, that's... It might not always be the way, but because that was the one that I'd heard, this is how you do it, I was obsessed with that approach rather than just going, what works best in this room in this moment?
Well, technology if technology gets in the way of the performance and the inspiration, then forget technology because... I mean, the number of times I'd record a demo on my cassette porter studio and the publisher would go, hey, that's good. We'll get you in the studio to make that a proper demo.
Yeah.
And you'd come out with something really anodyne and just insipid. And they'd go, oh, the song's sort of not as good now. And it's because you'd spent hours sequencing a little trumpet part that wasn't even a trumpet.
Yeah.
And so... I mean, I'd got a song called The Angels Are Crying Too that I put out on an album and it was just on a port studio and people loved that. But I tried to do demos of it and in the publisher's studio and it just didn't work. Just couldn't recreate that lovely spontaneity.
Yeah.
Same with filming, because I made a couple of films as John Shuttleworth. Yeah. The best one by far is It's Nice Up North, which was shot by Martin Parr, the international photographer, who's a good friend. And I met him when he photographed me for the Guardian when Five and the Bus Ops was coming out. And we both have sort of similar obsessions with the minutiae of life and particularly sort of northern life. And well, he takes photographs of light switches, you know, and they go for 10 grand, you know.
Yeah.
But... So we made this film, and he just filmed me going up to Shetland to see if it gets nicer the further north you go. And we literally had no agenda other than just chatting to people and going further and further north. And that was the beauty of it. When I did Five and a Bus Stops, I wanted to have some of that spontaneity, but because it was a BBC budget and we had quite a bit of a crew, it ended up all being scripted, and all the spontaneity and the accidental things that happened ended up on the... cutting room floor.
Yeah.
And it was such a shame. It was good, but it's nice up north. Suddenly we had we met a street cleaner up an alleyway and the conversation became about the rusty drain pipe and whether it needed painting with, and I was trying to think of a new painting with a coat of, and I couldn't think of the name of the paint. It went oxide, red oxide paint. And we started talking about that. So this guy created his own little character, you know, and then he went off and then another guy came up and he didn't seem, he was a bit embarrassed about the camera. So I just, in my voiceover afterwards, said, it's funny you meet one nice person and you meet one nasty one. You know, so these people are just ordinary people that become characters in the narrative.
Yeah.
That was such a lot of fun. But I want to do more stuff like that.
I've become
a bit lazy.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I would say you have to guard against. It's not necessarily complacency, it's laziness. It's as you get older, you just kind of, you spend longer thinking about things and rather than just doing them. Like when I was 18, I just did Jilted John. I've got to record it. And I think you've got to remember that and just bloody do it. I'd say that to anyone who wants to do something creative, record, film, radio show, just do it. This is what the podcast is all about,
yeah,
of course.
Exactly.
You're just doing
getting up and doing it yourself. And I think that's the perfect point. I think you can get lost in procrastination, in over a paralysis through analysis and all that kind of thing of just going, I don't know, or is this going to, like, you may now go, well, is this trip up north to see if it gets better the further north you go, is this going to produce anything good? Is it, do you know what I mean? You can stop yourself rather than just going, yeah, let's, well, the, let's yeah, get on with it.
I mean, with film specifically, the big problem is money. Mm. It's getting less like that now. Everyone can make their own film on an iPhone.
Yeah.
But a few years ago, I remember somebody, a friend, was waiting for a budget of £2 million to come through. Wow. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
But it was to make a film, and they had the cast line up. And then a few months later, said, how's it going? Well, we're still waiting on the money. And then a few months later, well, we've lost our backer, but we're hoping to get another one. The film never got made.
Yeah.
And that, you know, meanwhile, I'd gone and made It's Nice Up North.
Yeah.
For nothing, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's the Arctic Monkeys. That's popped into my head. They just did it, didn't they?
Yeah,
they just,
completely.
And they're brilliant. I mean,
and they just asked as well. They would ask Shane Meadows to do a music video for them. I was like, yeah, all right. Whereas most people go, I could never, you could never fit. No, we figured it out.
I should ask him because I've met him and he's a fan. So
yeah, well, perfect.
But he's I'm too lazy guy. To ask him.
Well, that's a perfect point to wrap things up on. What can people expect from this new tour, the 2020 tour that's going to be up and down the country? Is it? I assume it's going to be a lot of the classics and hits. Are we going to get updates of what John's been up to, of his life now? What's the plan?
It's a bit of that. It's a bit of the old, a lot of the old, but a lot of new as well. I wrote a song called Rapidly Downhill, which is a new one. It was on a radio show, but I think that's going to go down very well. That's all about, people say when someone's ill, terminally ill, they're going rapidly downhill. But the phrase itself is quite exciting, isn't it? It sounds like going rapidly downhill is fun.
Yeah.
So John's written a song saying, going rapidly downhill, rapidly downhill. The view's exciting, life's enticing, even when you're gravely ill. Going rapidly downhill, like skiing on snow, what a way to go. Hurry up and write your will. Rapidly downhill.
I love it.
Yeah.
That's going to be great.
There's a pun in this. All my shows have a pun, terrible pun. My favourite is The Minotaur and Other Mythological Creatures.
Yeah,
I had One Foot in the Gravy.
Yeah,
2000 and John going back a bit, but this one's John Shuttleworth back because I am back after a bit of a rest. But he's got a problem with his back, so he's going to be talking about that.
That's perfect. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to catching the return of John. Before we go, actually, tell me about your new book that's also out this year.
Yeah, I'm not that lazy. That's what I've spent most of this year writing.
I was going to say, we've just ended on talking of laziness, and then you're like, I've got a book, actually. That takes a lot of effort.
Well, it's called Two Margarines and not Other Mythological Creatures. Two Margarines and Other Domestic Dilemmas.
Yeah.
And it's basically a day in the life of John Shuttleworth. And it's like he's writing it into his dictaphone, and he's just walking around, getting in the way of his wife, but trying to look for domestic dilemmas. Like, here's one. What happens when the dishwasher door is open? How can you avoid bashing your ankles on it? The answer is you can't. It's insurmountable, that problem, which is probably why world leaders have never discussed it. The microwave plate, when it comes off the thingy in the middle. Well, John, it's called a coupler. It says in my Sanyo manual. It's a coupler. How do you get the plate back on? It takes a lot of effort. So it's silly dilemmas like that. You know.
I love it. I love it.
Choosing the right bag to go to the supermarket. Should you? Do you have to use one from that particular supermarket? Or would they be offended if you go in with a Sainsbury's bag to an Asda?
I love it.
What happens when they give you do you want? See, I'm going back to Mino. When they say, do you want your receipt? I have a real dilemma. Because I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
Because I want to save paper, but at the same time, what if it says £584 on there and it was only 12?
Yeah.
And I need some record. Also, John feels that, slipping back finally into John again, for the last time, what happens if it's a trick? Scroobius. You know, on the way out, the store detective might say, can I see your receipt, sir? Those goods look stolen. You've got no backup, have you?
Yeah.
They could arrest you. They could make you pay for everything again.
Almost all of these are things I've encountered in the last week, which is fantastic because I genuinely had it in the co-op yesterday they asked if I wanted my receipt. And as I was leaving, I was like, does that show a lack of confidence in their own wares that they're saying you might want to return this? I've said, no, I don't want a receipt. But hang on, your suggestion, I might want to return some of these. Have you just sold me a load of rubbish that I'm going to be like, well, I need my money back on this. This was below par. So it's a scary one.
Well, my solution is about, you know, not letting the store detective get you, is to have a selfie taken with the store assistant and, you know, perhaps you get the next customer who's waiting patiently in the line to take it of you with the thumbs up, you know, and then you can show that on your phone to the store detective on your way out. What do you think of that one?
I like it. No paper wasted. It's the eco solution. Well, thank you. We will end it this time. Thank you very much for everything there. It sounds fascinating. I'm looking forward to the book and the tour now. Is the book going to be on sale on the tour?
It is, actually. Yeah, the book's out in February, but the tour starts in January.
Yep.
And there'll be copies available from, yeah.
Excellent.
It's a paperback. I fought long and hard. They wanted it to be like a coffee table book, you know?
Yeah.
Costing a lot of money. I said, no, I want a cheap little paperback. Because, I don't know about you, but I read mostly at night.
Yeah.
And then just nod off. And it's that kind of book. It's a nice, gentle, reassuring little cosy paperback that you can just take an holiday as well, but you know, I think people will nod off mid chapter. You know? It's that good.
It's a shining endorsement. Well, thank you very much. Cheers.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Graham Fellows. I hope you enjoyed that. I loved getting into it with this guy. He's such an interesting dude. He's had a hell of a career. Yeah, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. As I mentioned at the end, tonight, Wednesday the 19th, he's at Lowry, Salford, then Newcastle, Tyne Theatre and Opera House, Scunthorpe Plowright, Wakefield Theatre Royal, Margate Theatre Royal, Brighton Old Market, London Leicester Square Theatre, Stafford Gatehouse, Manchester Dance House, Scarborough Spa Theatre, Bromsgrove Atrix Theatre, Tewkesbury The Roses, Nottingham Playhouse, Edinburgh Queen's Hall, Glasgow King's Theatre, Aberdeen Arts Centre, Louth Riverhead, Bury St Edmunds Theatre Royal, Cambridge Junction, London Bloomsbury, Wimborne Tivoli Theatre, Exeter Phoenix, Winchester Theatre Royal, Swansea Pontydwdl, I don't know how to say that, Arts Centre, Stamford Arts Centre and Barnsley Civic. That's between now and mid-April. So loads of opportunities to go and catch the return of the legend, the icon that is John Shuttleworth. And guess what? I'm going to give you an extra episode this week. In fact, I'm going to do that thing again where I get Buddy Peace to cut something out of the outro and put it in the intro. So I'm going to say this next bit as if I'm shocked and only just thought of it, because I have, but not when you're going to have already heard it in the intro. Let's do it now. Oh, and also, before I go into it, I'm going to give you a bonus podcast on Friday. I'm going to give you a chat with Rich Wilson, comedian and podcaster. I'm a big fan of his Insane in the Membrane podcast, and I saw his Fringe show and I thought he was wonderful, and he's got a Soho Theatre run coming up, so we're going to have a chat and I'll give you that on Friday. There we go. So Buddy, you'll now have to cut that in and you will have already heard it, and now you're hearing it in the outro as well, and you know that you peep behind the curtains. But if anything, it's an advert for the beast of a producer that is Buddy Peace, who produces all the best podcasts in the best ways. So and he's got his own podcast, Buddy's Buddies. So go and check that out. It sounds beautiful. That's it. I will be back next week. Who have I got next week? Obviously on Friday, as you just heard, I've got Rich Wilson, who's an absolute dude. I love his podcast, and you'll hear about that in the chat. So next week, I've got Mae Martin, a wonderful comedian and writer who's got a great new series on Channel 4 coming out soon. So we will be having a good old chinwag about that. So, yeah, I will see you Friday and next week. All right. Ta-ta.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.